this episode will be forever known as the Bag of Dongles episode.
That's right. I still don't have any dongles in the bag.
Whoa. Sorry about that.
Hello, friends. My name is Blue Mitchell.
And I'm Michael Kirchhoff. And these are
the Diffusion Tapes.
Welcome to the Diffusion Tapes, a podcast where we chat with artists, writers, and curators working in the field of artfully crafted photography. Produced and hosted by Blue Mitchell, publisher of Diffusion Annual and founder of 112 Publishing, co-hosted by Michael Kirchhoff, editor-in-chief at Analog Forever magazine and founder of Catalyst Interviews. In these conversations, we chat with folks whose fascinating work and intriguing life path arouse the senses. And we're inviting you into the conversation.
Tell me about Anne.
Yeah, what's funny about Anne is, for me, I don't really know Anne that well personally. So, because I've just seen her at festivals a lot, but I feel like I never get to spend any like quality time with her. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the reasons, because I always get along with her so well. So, which is one of the reasons I thought she'd be a good guest.
Maybe that's why, because you don't know anything about her.
I still don't. Fuck. I'm clueless, man.
We get along because I don't really know.
That's good. Yeah, so I was thinking about that later. I was like, you know, this was educational for me because learning about her past and kind of how she, you know, I look at her resume. I know I kind of knew what she'd done, but like her motivation and all that, I thought was pretty interesting.
It's funny that you mention her resume. Because if you were to read her resume and then talk to her about what she's done, the resume pales in comparison
to what
she's done, the experiences she's had, and the life that she's led in this community.
Oh, for sure.
She's worn so many hats and done so many things. When she talks about it, it's like, oh, well, then this year I was here, and this year I was there, and then I moved over here and I did this. And now I'm doing this, but I don't know if I'm not going to be doing this for another year, I'm going to go over here. Like, how do you keep track of it? Like, are you like running from the law? What's going on?
she's just following doors.
It's a life on the lam.
Right. today's guest is, her name is Anne Jastrup, Jackstrup, Jastrup, Jastrup. Jastrup, Anne Jastrup. Currently the executive director at the Center for Photographic Art in Carmel, California. Beautiful place. Anne grew up in the village of, is it Whitesboro, New York, or Whitesboro? I think it's Whitesboro.
Oh, I always thought pronounce it Whitesboro. Here we go again.
So she grew up in a little village outside of New York.
Mm-hmm. 12 people. All living together in a hut. No bathrooms.
In college, she studied literature and art, so she wasn't studying photography initially, and received her MFA from the Savannah College of Art and Design. I hear that's a reputable school.
It's okay.
Since then, she's been an educator for multiple organizations. So I say educator because that's like a generic term for saying all the crazy stuff she's done in a teaching capacity. She's a master printer. I didn't know that. She's an editor-in-chief, gallery director, executive director, portfolio reviewer, and master of the universe. And she still carries around a wooden view camera.
Who does that?
Anne does, and she's smart.
Wooden view camera? What kind of luddite is that? Actually, everybody goes, what the fuck is that? Never heard that word before. Actually, that's a really accurate thing. Anne is fucking smart. That's all there is to it. That's the bite. That's the soundbite.
Oh,
Anne is fucking smart.
Anne is fucking smart. But let's hear what she has to say about it. I just wanted to say, Thanks for finally getting on here. I know I invited you almost two years ago. Like, oh my God. Been a while.
Because
it was, well, a year and a half, because it was, you know, well before Footloose last year.
Oh, crap. Oh, that's right. And we were going to do it in Portland.
Yeah. Same then, same with Michael. We were going to do his as well in Portland when he was there. But I canceled on you both. Like, no, I can't do it.
I even had my hair done for that.
It was pretty amazing, too.
It's okay. It'll happen again someday.
You'll get your hair done again someday?
Yeah, someday. Okay.
That's fun. Yeah, so let's just jump in then. Thanks, Anne, for coming on to the Diffusion Tapes.
I know what we should start with, actually.
Yeah, start, Michael.
Because this comes up all of the time, and I can't tell you how many people have asked me instead of you
the what correct pronunciation.
Exactly. No, oh my God. That's a second question. Ooh. You know, honestly, the question I get about Anne more than anything else is, how do you pronounce her last name?
Oh,
good question.
Yeah. Everybody asks.
Yeah. Well, it's if since we live in America, you say Jastrab, which sounds like jockstrap. So, easy to remember. But if we lived in Europe, it would be Jastrab. Yeah, okay. But just go with the Jastrab or Jastrab.
You know what? I hear people say Jastrab more than anything else.
Oh, interesting.
So that's like it's like a hybrid of the two.
Yeah, in Eastern. It's Polish. So yeah, my great grandparents came to Ellis Island and they saw it was. There was a Z in there between the T and the R, and they were like, yeah, let's get rid of that. And then there was also another, like, two syllables at the end. They were like, let's get rid of that, too. That's not working. So it's like everyone with my last name in this country were related because we all got the butchered at Ellis Island. So.
Oh, right. Yeah, tracking.
I like that everybody that comes to the U.S., especially in the early days, they immediately had to dumb down their names because nobody else could get it right.
Here's your new name.
That still happens to immigrants. It's like, just call me George. Yeah. So much easier.
Yeah. All right.
Bill.
Totally.
So, Anne, where did you grow up then?
Oh, I grew up in upstate New York, outside of Utica, New York, kind of center of the state, closer to Canada than Manhattan.
Okay.
Yeah, Adirondacks.
And that was what, high school, college?
Birth to...
All of the above?
Birth to through high school and then left for college and also in upstate New York, but down in Oneonta. And then I went to grad school down in Georgia.
Oh, where?
It's SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design. Yep.
Lovely. What a great town.
In the early days, before it was a great town, it was...
Oh, really? So it wasn't a great town at one point.
I was there right when they were filming Forrest Gump, like before Forrest Gump was released. So right after that, it sort of started getting nice because tourists started coming. It was a beautiful city, though. It always was. Beautiful, beautiful city. Yeah. And then I went from there up to Maine to the Maine Photo Workshops and... I was a teacher there on the resident faculty after grad school, which was great.
I was going to ask you about that. You were working there full time then.
I did. I did year round. I was there in the mid 90s when the ocean froze in the winter. Oh. And they'd like cut off ferry service to the islands and you could like drive to Islesboro in your car across the frozen ocean. I was like,
whoa.
So when the people, it was like.
That sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not doing that. it was pretty intense those first winters, so I decided that maybe I would just teach in the summers, like 20 weeks in the summer in Maine. Pretty great.
The only time I've been to Maine is in the summer, so I can't even imagine being there with some of the storms that have rolled through there.
Well, the ocean doesn't freeze anymore, so it's I think it's a lot warmer.
Oh, so swimming is still an option then?
Yeah, swimming, still, polar plunge, piece of cake. You have to like carve a hole in the ice. It's like totally easy.
Oh my God, that sounds horrible.
Pretty horrible.
I don't think I'm up for a polar plunge. It's never been my bag.
Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Well, what was that like? It's main media now.
Yeah.
But back then, it was just, what did they call it? It was
the main photographic workshops, and then the the film and television workshops. So there were like two parallel schools, and then main media kind of covers the whole thing now.
Nice. Mm. What was that like? I mean, was it fun?
It was great.
Yeah. So were you shooting your own work at that time too?
I was. It was a very productive time. It's definitely like my coming of age time, I would say, my early 20s in Maine. Yeah, it was really glorious. So David Lyman, who was the owner of the workshops at the time, he was very supportive of me as like a 23-year-old fresh out of grad school. Kind of crazy. Took a big chance on me. I mean, to let me teach. I had like no experience at all. I mean, he was pretty amazing. So yeah, I made a lot of work. I was shooting with, a 4x5. I had a Linhof Technica back. I still have it. It's a great camera. But David also gave me a darkroom to, you know, of my own to make my work and print it. And
nice.
Yeah.
Why don't we see more of your work floating around?
Oh yeah.
Here, we could have a tour. Right.
Is that it?
There's some right over there. There's actually an Aline Smithson behind me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So something I do at CPA is that when I, you know, have a little too much to drink at the openings, I'll buy work I like and support the gallery.
That would be hard not to do.
Yeah,
I think.
Works out for everybody.
Another glass of wine and that piece is mine.
Right. I've got a little Paula Riff over there. Another.
Oh, man. Nice.
Yeah, another purchase that I'm glad I made.
That's great. Yeah. So anytime we see you getting a little bit tipsy, that's the time to hit you up for sales.
Yeah, pretty much. You're like, oh, do you like this?
Oh.
I love it.
Great. Now it's like immortalized. The cat's out of the bag. No.
We could go in this other room where it's like floor to ceiling photographs. It's definitely, I mean, it's like the hazard, I think, of working in a gallery, right? It's like.
Oh, yeah.
You become a major collector.
Yeah. You support artists in more than one way. So.
Right. That's great. Well, speaking of the gallery thing, so how did you get into doing gallery work from teaching?
Oh, so when I was in Maine, we had to, you know, it's pretty small year-round faculty, is we had to, you know, also install the shows in the gallery. And so, and, you know, the Union Hall where we installed the shows had this amazing, you know, it was built in like, I don't know, 1802, and the ceiling went one way and the floor went the other way, and they had to hang it in a straight line and make it look perfect. So we had to hang all the student shows, and you know, it was a lot of like hand cutting glass with like a little scoring tool and snapping the glass and like hanging them with L hooks and hammers, and I became very good at installing, and I really actually love installing. And also, you know, with teaching and working on portfolios and editing and sequencing. And when I came out to California, it's a very long, circuitous route, but eventually I was in San Francisco, and I applied for Rayco Photo Center, had a job opening in 2007 for gallery director. And I was like, oh, and I wrote in my application letter that I could hang a straight line, like, with these really extreme slanted ceilings and floors and make it look perfectly straight. And they were like, come on in. And then sure enough, Rayco from the entrance to the back of the building went down like a foot and a half. I was like, I got this. And it had this really long wall that was like all told about 700 inches long. And I was like, oh, I can do this. No problem. Make it look perfectly straight. So they hired me. And it was great. I had a fantastic boss there, Stuart, and he was owner of Rayco. And he was like, yeah, he's like, you know, show whatever you want, you know, just maybe occasionally run it by me. So he also gave me, you know, a lot of freedom, and I was able to support a lot of artists in the decade that I was there and start a lot of, like, our plastic camera show, which everyone loved. It was very beloved.
I love that show.
Because back when I worked in Maine, Maine was actually the Maine photographic resource at the time was the only place in the country you could buy a Holga camera in the early 90s. it was like the sole importer from China. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, I was teaching like zone system and stuff like that. But, you know, people get really hung up looking through their view cameras with their spot meters and being like, I just don't know where, you know, that zone four is. And I was like, oh, just stop. Just like, you're totally paralyzed. Here, shoot this Holga camera. It's like no controls. And they were like, I'm not shooting that. And I was like, I'm going to put it in the syllabus. So they had to. And and people really loved it. And it really like made people, really freed people up. Because they stopped thinking about like where to place the shadow detail and all that. And they just were free to see. And so when I started working at Rico, I said, Stuart, I want to do this crazy thing and start like an international plastic camera show. And he was like, yeah, all right. And so, so we did, and we did it for, you know, the 10 years that I worked there until Rico closed, and it was enormous. You know, it was always, we kept the price really low, you know, it was like $30 to enter, and we had entries really from all over the world. Like one time, I think we had artists from like 36 different countries in the show, even like, I mean, it was like Cyprus, and I learned a lot about international shipping. How hard, like you can ship something from that country, but you can't ship it back. Like that was really exciting.
Yeah. Customs regulations, all of that.
Yeah. It was really like Mexico. You could ship something enormous from Mexico, but you can never ship it back. So
right.
I actually once had to buy an intern a plane ticket to take a big piece back to Mexico. They were like, this is the best job I ever had. I was like, telling me. Wow. Yeah. But
it got there.
It got there. Got there safe and sound. Yeah. So Rico, so I ran the gallery there for 10 years. We had a great run there with a mix of, you know, we do the plastic camera show every year. And then we do one other juried show to kind of help raise funds to, you know, keep the place running. And every year it was a different themed show, like documentary or still life or travel or portrait. And then the rest of the shows were either solo shows from artists I met at like Photo Fest or Photo Lucida or Photo Nola or, you know, Review Santa Fe, these great portfolio reviews that I was able to go to in working at Rico. And then the other shows were like small group shows built around themes that I was seeing at the different portfolio reviews and with different artists that were coming into the gallery. So, yeah, it was great. And because of that, I got to, you know, curate shows in other places in San Francisco, like at City Hall, and do some civic shows, and it was really fun. When Rico closed, it wasn't just a gallery, it was this enormous photo center. It was like 14,000 square foot photo center with everything you need to make a photograph, and, you know, like 80% of the space was dedicated to analog photography, which is, you know, where I came from, because when I went to grad school, it was, you know, it's not to age myself, but it was like the first Photoshop was just being made with it. It didn't have layers, and it didn't have an undo button. Mm. So you couldn't like undo something once you did it. And I was like, forget this. Like, I'm going to specialize in historical processes. So, cause that'll never change. So I became a platinum printer. I mean, that's how I started shooting a big camera, was because of Photoshop, because I was so awful. But so when I, you know, that was one of the reasons I think Stuart hired me at Rico. I was like, yeah, I shoot a Linhof Technica and I'm like a total photo dork and I love to print in the darkroom. And he was like, great. And he actually hired me to print a huge show first before he put me in the gallery to be the director. He was like, wow, you're a good printer. I was like, thanks. but I still love that.
That was one of the great things that was about Rico. I mean, the plastic camera shows were like incredibly attended. I mean, I showed up at a few, I had been at a couple and showed up at a few, and they were like just hundreds of people milling about in there from all over the place. Like people would come from across the country to attend that show. Like they'd have like one piece, you'd have like 100 images on the wall and they're like, I'm going to San Francisco and I'm going to show up. Yep. But then the other thing is that there were dark rooms there. It wasn't simply a gallery space. It was, a community center for photographers.
Yep.
And that was what was really special about it.
Yeah, absolutely. We had those, we had that giant Colex color processor where you could make like mural size chromogenic prints, and you kind of had everything you needed to make any type of photograph. We had a mural sized silver gelatin darkroom and, you know, alternative process printing techniques and tin types and everything. And of course, a digital lab and scanners and all that. So it was, yeah. But, you know, scan your negatives. But, you know, people, it was a real, people were really sad when it closed. But, but there is a, you know, a little silver lining in that Stuart owns the building and he is renting out the space now to the California College of the Arts for their photography and printmaking programs while, cause they're breaking ground in a new building that I don't know when that'll be done, but.
So he left all the facilities in there. They're able to use all this
stuff. Well, he sold a lot of equipment, but the, you know, like the sinks and the stations and the, all the, a lot of stuff is still in there.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah. A new life to it, at least.
Yeah. A new generation of, you know, students that are in there.
And, is there any other, like, did anything replace that as far as, like, public being able to use darkroom in that area?
No, the East Bay Photo Co-op, they're trying to fill the void. They have a gallery space, and they were able to acquire Judy Dater's darkroom, actually, which is pretty amazing. But they just did a fundraiser because they just acquired the space next door to their gallery space that has running water. I think they're going to finally get to build out their darkroom. So that's happening. They just did an end of year fundraiser and got the funds to build that out. So that's good news for the Bay Area, for community darkrooms. And they there is Harvey Milk Center. There's always been Harvey Milk Center in San Francisco, but they don't have as, you know, as big of facilities as Rico did.
Yeah, I lived about a half a block away from Harvey Milk Center when I first moved to San Francisco. And that was, I mean, it was, I didn't know that it was there when I moved there. And I was like, this was clearly meant to be.
Right. Yeah. And it's cheap, like Parks and Rec. I think, you know, it's part of the Parks and Rec Department of San Francisco. So I think it's like you can print for a whole year for like $100 or something.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And back then, I don't want to date myself either, but it was like $20 on a dollar. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty great space.
That whole San Francisco community is exactly that. It's a really strong photographic community. This comes up all of the time on the podcast and other places too, but we always end up talking about community to a certain degree, and
absolutely
like Los Angeles and like Portland, where blue is, in New York, of course, Chicago, like all the major metropolitan areas, but San Francisco seems to be like, it's a very tight-knit community. Everybody really does know each other and work together and collaborate really well.
Yeah absolutely. It's very, it's,
and
a
I think
small
you're
town.
Kind of like, you're like the center of that. It seems to be, you know, you're, like you said, that was like a decade at Rako kind of puts you in that, you know, you're our dear leader now and we have to follow you wherever you go.
Come down to Carmel. It's not that far. It's right over here.
But that's what people do though, right? I mean, you've moved on, but
yeah.
How far is Carmel?
Carmel is about an hour and a half south of San Francisco.
Okay.
And I split my time between Carmel and Marin County in the North Bay, just north of San Francisco. So I can make it from up here, depending on traffic. I mean, that was been the great thing about the pandemic is less cars on the road, but I can make it in about, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes, 2:30. So it's not too bad.
Do you make that commute every week?
I do. I have a little, we jokingly call it the shack. I have a little shack down there that I stay in. When I go, if you guys come visit, you can come see it. It's small, but you know, it's like, it's three times bigger than my Manhattan apartment was. So for me, it's totally fine. But yeah, so.
That's a good comparison. Kind of gives you a ballpark of what it might be like.
Exactly. My apartment in Manhattan was 150 square feet, the whole thing.
Right.
Oh, wow. Yeah. God.
So this is like huge. It's
palatial.
Totally huge. But it's great. And you know, after Rako closed, I did work for a little bit at Scott Nichols Gallery in San Francisco. And I think that was actually great training to go on to Carmel, because in, you know, at Rako I'd worked with entirely living artists for the most part. I think we showed like one or two people who had passed away, but for the most part we were, you know, I was supporting emerging and established artists, but you know, I was really helping people move up in their careers. And then I went to work at Scott's, and like, it's Ansel Adams and Edward Weston and Wynne Bullock and Imogene Cunningham and all the F-64 photographers and Carlton Watkins and William Henry Jackson, like basically like all the dead people. And I used to joke with Scott, like, oh, the dead are the better, right? And he was like, totally. And I was like, what if we did this crazy thing where, you know, we're showing Edward Weston and Ansel and all those guys and gals, you know, Ruth Bernhardt and, you know, Barbara Morgan, we're showing all of them, but we're also showing like some living photographers, like kind of mixed in with them. And it really built out the community to do that. And, you know, Scott does show some living photographers like Monica Denovan and Rolf Horn and Jim Banks. You know, I was like, let's just bring in a couple local, let's just do this. And it was really great and fun. But I'd learned so much working at Scott's. Like, he'd have two Brett Weston prints in the inventory. And I was like, why is this one $25,000 and this one's $5,000? He's like, oh, just look at the signature. I'm like, mm-mm. And he would tell me like, oh, when he was signing it down here, that's a vintage print. When he signed it up here, it's a later print. And same thing with like, it's Edward Weston print. Why is this one $370,000 and this one's $10,000? It's like, oh, well, Cole Weston, his son, printed this one. So this one is an original EW printed in the year of the negative. And then you're like, oh my God. Because, you know, you look at the prints and it's like, and then you can also see the difference in their printing styles. Like, I learned so much working for him. So that way, when I did go down to Carmel and interview, I was like, I know all about your founding fathers of of the, you know, Friends of Photography, like, because the Center for Photographic Art occupies the old Friends of Photography space, which was founded by Ansel Adams and Edward West or Cole Weston and Wynne Bullock, you know, a bunch of guys down there. And so I knew all about them.
That was very serendipitous.
Yeah, totally. And so I actually have like, you know, that's how they actually convinced me to take the job down in Carmel, is Brian Taylor, who was the former director. He took me over to Wildcat Hill to Edward Weston's house and got me kind of drunk and was like, this could be your life. You just be sitting at Edward Weston's desk every day. And I was like, oh, this seems all right.
Does seem all right.
Yeah, it seems all right. It was pretty amazing. And beautiful. I mean, and yeah. It's funny when I do walk down from the shack down to the beach in Carmel, and I think, oh, right, that's why these photographers were here. It's just so beautiful. I mean, it's really kind of astounding. And I live in a beautiful place, and I lived in a beautiful place in Maine, too, and it's really gorgeous down there. So I see the appeal.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I can tell. Yeah. That's the one nice thing is, like, that coastline doesn't change that much, so...
No, well, hopefully not. It's getting hit by like 40-foot waves right now. They're evacuating like the lagoon where the Carmel River comes out right now. So,
yeah. Oh no.
Yeah.
Do they anticipate it flooding?
I think so. Or the maybe I don't know what they're anticipating, the cliff giving way, but. Yeah, I'll be down tomorrow. We're actually, we have a couple shows opening this weekend, so I'll be down tomorrow and I'll see what's going on. Hopefully we'll have power.
Well, I was going to say, we talked to Stu Levy and he was talking about coming down there and doing workshops with Ansel. Yeah. So his connection down there was like, we talked about that history quite a bit. I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah. We just had Chris Pickler from Nisraeli Press. He was supposed to do in 2020, the 30th anniversary of Nisraeli Press show, but of course there was a pandemic, and so we ended up doing the 32nd anniversary show this summer. And when we were playing the show, he said, you know, I came here when I was 18 and studied with Ansel, and it's so great to be back. This is kind of like where I came of age. He took a workshop with Jerry Uhlsman and Imogene Cunningham and Ansel Adams. I mean, it's like amazing. Yeah, my desk is like where Ansel's was, which is pretty funny. It's like,
you feel that spirit?
I feel the spirit
hovering over you.
Well, yeah. I swear that the old kitchen, I think Cole Weston's dark room was underneath it. And sometimes in the kitchen, I'm like, I smell Fixer.
Fixer.
It's like the ghost of Cole Weston. It's like bubbling up through the sink.
It's very distinct.
Yeah,
very
there's distinct, like, the old Friends of Photography sign, the old darkroom sign's like screwed into the wall in there.
Nice. Wow.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to joke when I was in school that I'm going to invent a cologne that smells like Fixer. And that's like the best name for a cologne, too.
Fixer. Yeah, Fixer, totally.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, it would have an appeal.
To some people.
Until they smell it, yeah.
Only to a few people that know what it is. Otherwise, what the hell?
It's like very nostalgic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I love you.
That's how you find the photographers in the crowd.
Right, yep. Right. Yep. Yeah, totally. How to weed them out.
They're the only ones that will hang out next to you while you're wearing that stuff.
Photographer pheromones. Speaking of Fixer, tell me about this. I looked at your LinkedIn. You were a master printer at the Academy of Motion Pictures. Arts and Sciences? What was that all about?
I did some little secret projects for them back when I first moved to LA from Maine back in 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. So I got to print some special projects for them. Like I did some platinum prints of The Killers. A lot of old movies, so like large format negatives, like 8x, this is back in the day when they were shooting, you know, 8x10 stills on set. So what's that, Ava Gardner and Burt Lancaster, I did some platinum printing for them. And then I also did, I got to print the Thomas Crown Affair negatives, which for, you know, I think part of the reason why they hired me was because I don't know who anyone is. Like I looked at a book of photographs of Hollywood stars, and I was like, out of 50 stars, I identified one, and the rest I did. And they were like, "You're hired. you won't steal the prints because you don't even know what you're printing." But I did. The exciting thing about the Thomas Crown Affair was the they handed me the negatives and they were like black squares. I was like, "What is like?" It was like jet black, and I was like, wow. "What?" I was looking at them, and then I had them on the light table. And I didn't see anything, and I put them up to the light. I was like, "There's nothing on these negatives." And they were like, "Yeah, those are Richard Avedon's negatives." And I was like, "Oh, well, and so I guess sometimes he would just put the developer in the tank and then go to lunch, come back." And so they were like bulletproof negatives. And whoa.
Oh my God.
I mean, I'm a good printer, but I was like, I mean, that Thomas Crown Affair almost broke me. Like it literally, like, so it's like Faye Dunaway, right? And my manager was like, "We have to have her cheekbone come out or you're fired." And I was like, "Wait, okay." And so literally it was like printing the black square, which I was like, "Yeah, sure, she's in there somewhere." Printing the black square, it's like 300 second exposure, wide open with a 00 filter, and then a 600 second burn wide open to just get the faintest little cheekbone. I was like, and then he's like, "Why is it taking you so long to print these?" I was like, "Oh, I don't know."
Right.
It could be the exposure time. But yeah, so I got to print a lot of really interesting things. It's really funny. I got to print some One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Marilyn Mark shot the stills on set for that movie. And so I cared about that. And my bosses were like, whatever. You know, like, I was like, "But it's Marilyn Mark." But who actually had assisted back in Maine. So for me, it was a big deal.
That's what was funny is you didn't know the people in the photographs, but you knew the people who took the photographs.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, I got to print a lot of Harrell negatives. And I mean, what a master of lighting. Yeah, but mostly like 8x10s and 4x5s, the large format stuff. Some glass plate of like Charlie Chaplin, Lon Chaney, a lot of... You know, the Hollywood folks out there will know who I'm talking about. But Buster Keaton, got to make some beautiful, I got to print Double Indemnity, which was such a beautiful movie. I mean, that was the thing, too. It's like, "You're printing Double Indemnity." I'm like, "Well, I don't know, what's that?" And they were like, "Oh, come on." They're like, "It's like the most beautiful film noir movie ever." And I was like, "Of course it is, of course." And so then where I was printing, there was a giant television set, and they would pull a red ruby lit filter down over the TV, and they'd be like, "You watch this while you're printing." I'm like, "Yeah." So I was like, okay, I'm going to multitask me watching this movie while I'm like pulling prints. It was really fun.
Well, if you're burning in a cheekbone for 10 minutes, then
you got time. You got plenty of time.
Yeah. I mean, your arm might be cramping up, but
do you know, I still have never seen the Thomas Crown Affair. I never kind of got past. You know, what's really funny is I went to the SF MoMA when I was living in San Francisco after LA, and the Richard Avedon retrospective was there, and I was walking through, and then, you know, these huge mural size prints that are like, you know, I mean, the size of a billboard, and I'm in there looking at them, and these people behind me are like, wow, these prints are pretty contrasty. And I was like, it's like, these prints look fucking awesome. Are you kidding? Like, I was like, you don't even know. Like, this look great, I just have to say. So I have like a whole, whoever printed his negatives, a whole new respect. I think they're amazing.
Love it.
Oh, you have to delete the swearing. Sorry.
No, we encourage the swearing.
Oh, okay. You don't have to bleep that out.
No, no bleeping.
It's not appropriate for kids, I think. Like, my kids can't listen to the first season of the Diffusion tapes because several of them are marked explicit.
Oh, so wow.
They can't like stream it. I'm like, sorry guys, you can't stream your papa.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. It's until you're 18.
Right. Yeah.
Right. You use them as a lesson, as a crash course of how to swear.
Oh,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually surprised when I started the podcast how often we all swear. I was like, oh, these have to be marked explicit. And I had no idea. I didn't know.
When I was hired at Carmel, I had to give a talk to the community to tell them about who I was and put together a slideshow. So, yeah, I taught with a lot of great photographers in Maine who they would know, like Paul Caponegro and George Tice and stuff. So, and I put together this kind of star-studded slideshow, and also with lots of pictures I'd printed from the Motion Picture Academy.
So you were name dropping?
Well, definitely. Because I was like, I've got to like win them over, right? I've got all these like Humphrey Bogart and Shirley Temple, Harrell pictures, you know, that are like gorgeous. But then after I showed all the, you know, different things I'd curated at Rayco and et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, I was like, and these are all these prints that there's like pictures of me framing an Ansel Adams print. I was like, here's me and Ansel, nice. Right? Like, I know what nice. I'm doing, right? Here's After the talk, my board president came up to me and he was like, so you said the F word 3 times. I was like, I did not. And he was like, oh, you did. And, I was like, and he was like, and this was not the place. And these were not the people. And I was like, okay, well, I can't take it back now. And I was like, and I think I wasn't really, I was like using it like when Mary Ellen Mark swore. It was her swearing. It wasn't actually me swearing, remember? And he was like, yeah, no, still doesn't count. And I was like, okay. But then afterwards I saw my, I have a whole bunch of volunteers who, some of them are from the East Coast like me. And I was like, did you guys hear me say the F word? And they were like, fuck no. All right,
that's classic.
yeah
but that's right, it's the audience that's picking up on it.
Right.
So they've come to, I think it, when they first hired me, they were like, oh my god, what have we done, we've hired like this rebel from San Francisco. But now they're like, oh, it's okay, you know, she's all right, she's gotten us through the pandemic.
Right. Well, you also went in there on, you know, high recommendation from Brian, I imagine, right? And then,
yeah.
And he had been there for quite a while, too.
He'd been there for 5 years, yeah.
Oh, was it only 5? I thought it was longer than that.
Yeah, he taught before that, he was teaching at San Jose State for like 30 years, I want to say. He had a long career there, maybe 25 years, but a long time.
Who's this you guys are talking about?
Brian Taylor, who's an amazing artist, actually. Incredible. Oh,
yeah.
So he's.
Yeah, I just wanted to put it on record.
Yeah. Brian Taylor retired to go back to the darkroom. And so he's like cranking out these beautiful gun by chromate cyanotype prints. Mm-hmm. He's doing amazing work. But yeah, when he hired me, because I was working at Scott Nichols then, when he hired, well, it wasn't him that hired me, but when he recommended the board interview me, and then the board hired me. Scott Nichols came down to the party where I was being hired. There was like a passing of the baton party between Brian and I. And Scott walked up to Brian and was like, you're a dead man. And I was stole like, oh. her. I was like, Scott does love me. He just doesn't know how to show it.
That's pretty good. But then he moved.
He did. He moved the gallery. He'd been dealing photographs in San Francisco since 1980. And after, oh my God, 40 years, he moved up to Sonoma.
Right.
So it was a big change for him. And I think he's looking not to come back to San Francisco, but to come a little further south. I mean, it's kind of tough timing. He moved in 2019 and then, you know, pandemic hit, and tough time to be moving a gallery space, I think. But
is he in Sonoma proper?
Like, yep, Sonoma? He's downtown Sonoma.
Oh, cool. Well, I have family down there. I'll have to go visit.
Yeah, he's right on the square. He's, you know, not far from the Sonoma Valley Museum of Art, which actually shows a lot of great photography shows. Linda Keaton's the director there. She does a good job.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a tough time. The pandemic was a tough time for all galleries. I mean, what were you doing at the center during that time? I mean, did you just move everything online?
We really quickly moved everything online, like within a week. I was like, we gotta, yeah. I knew. I was like, this is not gonna be just a couple weeks. And we just opened a show I curated called the Winter Blues. It was a contemporary Sanitype show. Actually, it had Paula Riff in it. That's where I drunkenly bought that print. And Brian Taylor, actually, I put in the show. He had some new Sanitype work that was gorgeous. And it was a really beautiful show. And it just opened on February 29th, 2020. And then we had to close the gallery on March 13th. Yeah, we did everything online. You know, we just closed the gallery. The space was entirely shut. And then we reopened that show in July 2020 for one weekend before finally putting up the member show that had been like sitting in my office for months at that point. Everybody was like, the pandemic's over. And everyone rushed the gallery and they bought like so much artwork. And I was like, holy, I was like, if this is the way it's going to be, I was like, this is amazing. Like, people, I think, were really convinced that it was over in some weird way, but we sold a ton of work. I mean, I think pieces in the show that I didn't think would sell. I mean, they just sold. People were like, that's available. I'll take it. Like, I was like, great. And then we had the members show, the 2020 member show. We opened and we sold a ton of work from that. And then of course the fall came and then it all spiked again. And it was like, but throughout it all, we've kept our programming online. We're still doing artist talks online because something that happened during the pandemic was we almost quadrupled our membership because we made everything free for members. And then, you know, for non-members, be $10 to attend a talk. So, you know, there's definitely some people, I'm not going to name names up in case they're listening, but they've come to every single talk. They've definitely gotten the most of their like $50 membership.
That's good.
They've been to like 300 talks at this point. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. So, and I love them for coming to every talk. I mean, it's like actually great. And it's fun because people really, so we have, you know, members on all the continents now, except Antarctica. You know, people really came to know each other and like, we'd all be, you know, like the Zoom talks would be all full for like the first couple of years. And people would be like typing in the chat, like, did Ernie Loopy get a haircut? You know, they've never met, right? I'm like, that's, oh, it's Ernie. Yeah, he did. You know, it's really funny. And yeah, so we also have Brenton Hamilton, who is my colleague back in Maine at the Maine Photo Workshops, who is also at my Sanitype show. He's been doing a special series of history of photography lectures for us. Those have been great and well attended. And I think kind of, you know, it's a mix of, you know, people from Maine and people from California, and like the communities are merging, and it's really been good. So we're still, yeah, like I said, we're the gallery's open back to normal hours finally. You know, we're open 5 days a week again, but we're still doing the online programming for our members on all the continents. So,
well, you created a whole new community there. Speaking of community, like that whole online community, I didn't get on much of those Zooms because it conflicts with my work schedule, but yeah. The one I did get on is like, I could tell that there was regulars
right
that came on, you know. It's like, and then I recognized so many people's names, and then I knew they weren't all local to you, so I was like, oh, there's a whole new community going on here. So that was pretty cool.
It's really great. We even made for the Brenton's class, we did a like a tour t-shirt, like the pandemic history of photography tour t-shirt with all the lectures listed on the back, like a like a rock concert tour.
That's great. That's great. I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty. It was. I was pushing for the Brent and Hamilton to be in the Metallica font, but I think that was like a little too racy for Carmel. Exactly.
They just don't get it.
I was like, it's a little. Yeah, they didn't recognize it. They were like, it seems so scary. I was like, no, that's not. It's a Metallica. It's not. They're my neighbors. They're fine.
Yeah, it'd just be too much explaining.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we'll go for this like it's a rock font instead.
Right. Sure. Yeah. That's good.
So it's really fun. We did Brenton came back to start a new contemporary history series this year, and everyone was wearing their Brenton Hamilton t-shirts in the lecture. So really,
that's sweet. Really
cute.
Groupies.
Yeah, yeah, totally it. Groupies.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, really good.
Brenton, I think I showed his work way back in the day on my Plates to Pixels website when that was around. So
yeah.
I was an early fan of his.
Yeah, he and I, when my first years teaching in Maine, we lived across the hall from each other in the old bank building in Rockport. Like both of our apartments had giant bank vaults in them. So I used to make my platinum prints in my vault.
That's fantastic.
And he had two bathrooms in his apartment, and he used to have one bathtub was the Sanitype bathtub that he would secretly make those beautiful Sanitypes in. So he had a blue bathtub.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. What year was that, Anne? Not to date you.
That was, geez, 96 maybe? Okay.
Yeah.
95, 96, 97, those years.
It'd be fun to get a hold of that bathtub.
I know. You could probably sell it on eBay.
The Brenton Hamilton Sanitype bathtub.
Yeah.
So you can make a shirt out of that, too, probably.
Yeah. I think oh, my God. That would be great. Yeah, I think Rockport, they've turned the bank building into, like, kind of fancy apartments, which it definitely wasn't. It was, like, nasty old carpeting when we lived there.
It remodeled it. I wonder if they still have the vaults. And
God, I hope so. It was so cool.
That'd be cool. I mean, yeah.
They actually had my apartment, so they had put a bed in the vault, and they was like, yeah, this is your second bedroom. I was like, who wants to sleep in the vault? Like, with the chance that maybe the door gets closed. I mean, like, and there's no windows, of course. It's a vault. Like, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just go in there because it's light tight. I'm gonna make my emulsion in there. But
not
otherwise,
sleep in here.
I'm not to sleep in there. Like, have a panic attack.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. It's funny. I see so many all over the country, and so many different people who, as photographers and artists, they always end up in old bank buildings. Like that seems to be the most suited place for an artist to land. And then somehow the bank vault is always put into the mix as a workspace in some way.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's actually my job is in an old bank building, and I used to be in the well, when we pre-pandemic, I was in the basement, which is where the vault was down there. But
yeah, I work in a space now sometimes that the hair and makeup area is the old bank vault.
That's funny.
Yeah,
I guess there was a lot of bank buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's happened. I remember doing an assisting job for a photographer from the New York Times who came to LA when downtown LA was really just not the place you wanted to be. And it was all about the real estate being sold, all these old bank buildings. And we went to all these different buildings and talked to these developers and photographed all of these spaces. And now all of those spaces are like crazy amounts of money to purchase. You can't rent any of them. You know, you used to rent them for $5, but now, now they're like millions of dollars to purchase.
Wow.
So it always ends up happening with those spaces, but they're amazing.
Yeah. I used to live in a loft down on Santa Fe and Olympic. Back in like the 2001, it was pretty rough.
Not great.
Definitely not great.
Yeah. I lived downtown in the early 90s and it was really bad.
Oh my gosh, I can't even. Yeah.
Yeah. I moved back to town 5 days before the riots broke out, so things were things changed.
Yeah.
But now it's great. I mean, now it's pretty amazing down there. But yeah. I mean, we see that happen in a lot of different cities, too. I mean, it's happened in San Francisco and LA and New York, yeah. Certainly. I mean, look at the meatpacking district in New York.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
What a horrible place
that had been.
And now it's like, it's not the same place at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're really saying is photography is not where it's at. It's real estate.
Yep. That's really, that's how we wrap it up. Buy that cheap real estate.
That's funny. And I'm curious, you talked a little bit about doing photo festivals and stuff like that. Do you have, I mean, you seem like you go to a lot of festivals. Do you have a favorite? Is there one that you like to go to the most? I know it's hard to pick favorites, especially on recorded live.
Right.
or is one deemed more valuable than others?
Ah, there you go.
In terms of the quality of the work that you're going to see.
Oh, that's even a more loaded question.
Yeah, we're just trying to get you in trouble.
Well, I have to say I love Photo Lucida. That's my favorite. I can just say it, right? It's like...
Sure,
yeah.
I mean, isn't that where I met you guys?
Yeah. Yeah.
I might have met you, actually, maybe. Review LA.
That's right.
A million years ago. But Photo Lucida, I think, has a great sense of community, like, especially when it was back at the Benson, and you'd be like go down into the bar and viewing portfolios in the bar and hanging out. And there was just a nice community feeling to that. And the same thing with Photo Nola. Also, there was a great like community feeling, like everyone hanging out together, reviewers and participants. Photo Fest, I've definitely found, especially the early days that I was going to Photo Fest, like 2008, 2010, 2006, 2000, you know, those early years, I saw a lot of amazing work, like really, really finished work that was just ready to be like solo show on the wall. So that, I mean, and I met a lot of great colleagues and friends there that, I mean, it's so massive, but Photo Fest is a little different because, I mean, I think it might have changed. It was a little bit different this year, but in the past they would, you know, kind of put the reviewers on one bus and take you off somewhere else. So you didn't really interact with the participants as much. You were sort of more segregated, but I definitely saw a lot of really good work there over the years. And Review Santa Fe too. I definitely gave a lot of solo shows from work I saw at Review Santa Fe in the, you know, a decade or so ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, you know, these past couple of years when the reviews have been online, I mean, I think the New England portfolio reviews were done really well online, and the Denver portfolio reviews, you know, the people, they did them online, but it still wasn't the same as like that sitting across from someone and like looking at their prints and shaking their hand and taking their business card. And it was like, it was just a little bit different. And that was also harder for me to like, I mean, I look at so much work online that it's like a nice break to not look at work online and to see it physically. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the last couple of years of reviews that were digital, you know, they were good, but it was just different. Oh, and I should also mention Photo Alliance. That's our portfolio review here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I've met a lot of great artists and shown a lot of work through them too. You know, Linda Connor, she's really the driving force behind Photo Alliance. Was there. Photo Alliance, actually, and Center for Photographic Art were born from the ashes of the Friends of Photography. But Linda has been like a driving force behind that since it began. She's amazing. And that review is, you know, that nonprofit goes on because of her sheer willpower. But she always said, oh, Photo Alliance is kind of, you know, it's a starter review, you know, and it's like not like Photo Fest. Like if you're not ready for Photo Fest, go to Photo Alliance and like learn what it's about. And it's much, you know, people are like really supportive and really sweet, and you're all eat lunch together and you're all outside. And it's, of course, that old San Francisco Art Institute campus, you know, that where Ansel Adams started the photography program, right? It's like, I mean, that campus is so beautiful. We can see the whole San Francisco Bay, and it's amazing. Of course, that they're in the transition now, too. I feel really lucky that I've gotten to go to all these reviews over the years and gotten to meet all these artists and see all this great work that, you know, I would not get to see sitting in a gallery, you know, like just sitting at work. Like the fact that we get to go and travel these places and meet all these people, it's been a real honor. So I feel very lucky.
Have you gained any BFFs at the festivals?
BFFs? Yeah, I don't want to leave anybody out. I've definitely...
Oh, you don't have to name names.
Okay, yeah, I definitely have bonded for life with several.
That's great.
Yeah. Don't have to use our names specifically. You know. You don't want to embarrass anybody or leave anybody out.
Yeah. I mean, we got to go to, speaking of international reviews, going to like Li Shui in China. Like I met, right? Well, there's two Chinese reviewers that were at Photo Lucida. Guo Jing is there now. And I went to Pingyao with her. And then...
Yan Li,
thank you. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I got to go to Li Shui. I mean, and then it was, like, amazing to do an international portfolio review and have a translator and see, like, really incredible work. And super interesting to go to a different culture and be like, wow, here we are on the red carpet. Like, little old me.
Yeah.
And then, Michael, you were, like, a rock star there. They were like, hello. Hello, mister. Like, people were like knocking me out of the way to get to Michael, and they're like, oh, take my picture with him. I'm like, okay.
You have to put on the wide angle lens. Really, everybody was half my size.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So great. Yeah. Really fun. Yeah. You were like, you had to like fight off the paparazzi. Like, hey.
Yeah. People use me as a point of reference when trying to get through a crowd.
Yeah.
Oh, they're like, guy. See that guy over there? Just head his way. It was like a beacon.
So fun.
Well, I didn't realize you were such a rock star over there, Michael. That's good.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You and Jim Stone, because he looked like Ansel Adams. People were like, oh.
That's right. Man,
two of us. I'm like,
that's good.
That's good. Really great.
But you're right. That was fun, though. I mean, from an international perspective, I mean, it was really... I mean, I was on the other... I was, you know, showing work at that point, but being able to show work to people who had little or no English at all, and then you're sitting there with a translator. I mean, trying to navigate how that really worked was interesting in itself. You know, I mean, it became less photographic and more, I mean, cultural, really, because you just couldn't, like, you just... I mean, how many times did we look around and you're like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
I feel completely lost right now.
Those opening ceremonies with like, I don't even know. It was like the Olympics. I was like, but it's just our little photo festival. But here we have like the, you know, all these acrobats and like the blind children with the batons. I don't even know. I was like,
what does this have to do with photography?
Yeah, they go all out for that
all
festival.
Out.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a whole diffusion crew go over too.
That's right.
Yeah.
You didn't get to go though, right?
No, I had a family emergency, so I couldn't make the trip. I had to cancel. Right. But it was funny though, because, you know, Heidi and those guys, they'd send me photos in like, you know, my face is up on all these billboards and stuff. I was like, what the hell?
Yeah. Heidi Kirkpatrick, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I was like, great. What is going on? Yeah, so, yeah, she curated all of them, all but, like, one of the artists were out of the pages of Diffusion for that show. So it was cool, yeah. I was sad I couldn't go, but it's all right. I got to see myself on the billboard, so that'll never happen again.
Never know.
Yeah, yeah. None of us have ever been more newsworthy.
Yeah.
We're huge in China. Nobody knows who we are here. Right. We're huge in China.
Yeah, I went to a couple other international ones. I went to Guada Photo in Guatemala City with Laura Moyo, actually went from Photo Lucida, and it was amazing. They had taken over like every abandoned building, parking garage, bus stop, billboard in the entire city of Guatemala City for Guada Photo. And it was photography everywhere. Like everyone's work was featured in these like really interesting exhibition venues. It was, I was so impressed. And we did portfolio reviews there, and I got to see again, how am I ever going to get to see the work of like Guatemalan students? Like that. It was incredible.
Right.
And, that's fantastic.
And then we did, I went to South Korea and went to the Seoul International Photo Festival. And I talk about being welcomed. It was like, you're the honored guest. And so you have to be careful there what you ask for, because I just say things like, oh, I love karaoke. And then the next thing you know, like a new bus pulls up and they're like, for you, karaoke. Karaoke bus. I'm like, oh no. I'm like, I'm not drinking right now. It's noon. And they're like, No, for you, karaoke bus. I'm like,
wow,
sober. And they're like, for you, karaoke. And then I had to sing sober in front of like 70 people driving through Seoul. I mean, it was terrible. It was like, I shamed my country. It was awful.
How come they didn't roll in the liquor bus for you?
Well, yeah. Well, it was amazing. Yeah, they weren't getting the clue that like, I actually don't know how to sing. That I was like, yeah, no, this is like, and so I think I sang, oh, it was terrible. I sang John Denver, Take Me Home, Country Road. And I could see, because I had to look out at the bus, and I could see their faces, like sort of like the horror on their faces. And then the head of the festival, after I finished singing, he goes, and then he took the mic from me, and then he goes, I'll sing. And then he like busts out. He's like, I mean, he was like a Broadway star. I was like, oh my God. And then everyone got up and sang, and they were all amazing. And then I really had shamed my country.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So
I'd like to know if there's video of that somewhere.
I really, I think it's long enough ago that I don't think there was, you know, there probably were just starting to be cameras on cell phones, but I think I'm safe.
Okay. Oh, that's too bad.
It really was just awful. It was so awful. It was fun.
Oh, here's something for you.
Okay.
I read this.
Oh, no. It's not true.
It's not about you. It's not about you directly. But I like this quote, and you need to tell me if you can tell me who wrote it.
Is this part of the game show where
this is our game, yeah.
Okay. There's a prize.
We must be willing to let go of the life we have planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us.
Oh, I've heard that quote.
I knew you have.
It does sound familiar.
But who has that in their email signature? Can I do a quick search?
I thought you might, actually.
No.
It would be something in your signature.
No, who said it? I don't know.
E.M. Forster.
Oh, yeah. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on him. I should have known that.
I know.
No wonder it sounds so familiar. But that's my little secret.
That was
secret.
A trick question, because I knew that you knew who it was.
Oh, my God. Did you know? Does it say somewhere that I wrote my English thesis on E.M. Forster?
I'm just... What's that? Who's that guy who wears the funny hat who does those interviews on YouTube? And he always asks people like the most random personal stuff, and people are always like celebrities, and they're always like, "How did you figure that out?"
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about?
No,
Michael.
No, I don't know.
I'll send you guys a link to his stuff.
Okay.
He does these interviews, like, but he does very thorough research on people, and and like contacts their family and friends privately without them knowing, and gets like a bunch of information about them, And then he'll spring like these questions on people, and they're like, "How the fuck do you know that?" He's really good at it.
Sounds dangerous.
I should do that on the podcast. That's my.
I was going to say that's like season 4 of the Diffusion Tapes, right?
Throwing your interviewee off guard, like, holy shit! No, I did read it somewhere in one of your interviews. I think.
The E.M. Forster quote.
Not the quote, but the author, yeah.
Funny. Yeah. I think there is a terrible video interview from my graduate school where I think I'm talking about E.M. Forster, maybe. But I hope don't go looking for that.
Meanwhile, our listeners are like Googling.
Yeah, exactly.
He wrote A Room with a View. You know, the amazing thing about E.M. Forster is all of his books were turned into movies. So,
oh, actually, that's something you mentioned, and I thought that was curious. Name a few, then.
So, A Room with a View, Passage to India, Howard's End, Maurice, the terrible book, terrible movie, very autobiographical. There's so many. I'm spacing them out now, but
that's a good list already.
Yeah, Howard's End for the win if you're going to read one, or Room with a View if you're a hopeless romantic.
I've seen that, but I haven't read it. Nice, good stuff. Well, what about you, Michael? How are you doing over there?
I'm good. The other thing that I wanted to kind of backtrack about at the portfolio reviews, because like you said, you talked about when we first met, and I think you're right. I think it was review. LA. It was like the offshoot from Review Santa Fe, yep. right? It was probably like, I don't know, 2009 or some, maybe. Okay. It was the dark ages.
Yeah.
For us, yeah. Yeah, because we're so young.
We were just kids.
Yeah, yeah. Toddlers, in fact. And and the one thing, I think that you were actually the very first reviewer that I ever saw for fine art photography. Because I've been involved with commercial photography.
I remember you had your Russia stuff.
Right. Yeah. So, and I remember sitting down at the desk, across the desk, at the table across from you, and you were crying. somebody had just showed you some work that got you like over completely emotional.
Wow.
And you were literally like wiping tears off your face. And I just remember thinking, this is not the start that I was looking for when I sat down. Like this, I don't think that this person is in the right frame of mind to be looking at anything. But of course, you're the professional and you definitely held it together. And now fast forward to April of this year, 2022, or last year, 2022, because it's 2023 now, at Photo Lucida. Now I'm on the other side of the table and I'm also reviewing work. And you were at the desk. I keep saying
table,
desk. At the table next to me. There was another point in time. I think there was more than once that you
cried,
teared up and got. And I remember, I think I know whose work it was too, because I was really kind of like, whoa, like taken aback. I don't think that I cried. Maybe when I got back to my room. But but yeah, I mean, you take it all to heart. You get very, you're involved in it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's involuntary, right? The reaction, like I can't fake that. It would be amazing. I'd be in Hollywood if I could fake that.
And you weren't even drunk.
And I wasn't even drunk, and I wasn't singing. Yeah, it was like, I do those reviews sober, in case there's a rumor going around that I don't. Totally sober.
I don't know who would start that.
Yeah. I don't know. I never drink. It's so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely, it's actually kind of nice when it happens, right? That you have like a visceral response to something.
Right.
And I can't remember, what the work was. I do remember there were two moments.
But it was a conversation. I remember, at least at Photo Lucida this last time. I mean, there was a conversation amongst reviewers later about, oh, did you see that work? And oh, I cried and I was upset. And I mean, some of the work it really does. I mean, it definitely pulls at the heartstrings. And
I thought this 2022's Photo Lucida, there was some particularly good work, good projects, moving projects. Yeah. It wasn't just like technically good. It was like emotionally, it was invested work.
Yeah. I thought it was kind of, honestly, across the board, it was very valuable. Not Review Santa Fe in 2022, but 2019, same thing. It was a lot of really strong work. And actually that's probably another kind of topic to hit on is like, I've heard lately that the quality of the work that you see come across the table isn't as strong. Like there's more people who are doing it as like a hobby and they just have the money to do the portfolio reviews. But I kind of don't see that. I mean, if anything, maybe I'm just lucky, but I mean, I think by and large, most of the work that comes my way is analog based, even though that's not entirely all I'm ever looking for.
Yeah.
But I think the quality of the craftsmanship, the intention behind the work, it's all really, really strong. And yes, there's always going to be some people who are hobbyists or, I have, a lifetime career as a doctor and I could just afford to do this. And here's my snapshots. But I mean, that's bound to happen no matter where you go. But I think that the work that we see these days is really strong.
Yeah. I thought that review, I was at that same Review Santa Fe 2019. I thought that was really a really good one. Really.
Yeah. We have the benefit of having last names that are close together in the alphabet. So.
It's true. You're always somewhere near me.
Yeah, always nearby, lurking.
It's good. It's really good. Yeah, I think that's maybe what was missing in the online reviews was.
The reaction isn't going to get as visceral, I think, because it isn't face to face.
And I think it's easier for people when it's online for them to just read their statement to you, as opposed to when they're sitting across from you, they have to pitch it, right? They have to like have it ready to go, as opposed to being like, okay, and then they just read it and you're like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. My one pet peeve is the people that sit across from you and then they have their artist statement typed out on a piece of paper and then they just hand it to you and say, here, read this. And you're like, I'm not gonna read
this. No, right, I'm not gonna read this.
You tell me.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's why you gotta practice those pitches.
Yeah.
And so I think it's actually at Photo Fest there were a number of artists I met who were had great pitches, great work that I've asked to give talks at CPA this coming year. Because I was like, you know, I don't think this work's necessary for our community, but I think this is really interesting work, and I think they really delivered it. It's like, okay, let's do it. Let's do an hour.
It's a big deal being able to talk about your work. It's hard to talk about your own work, number one, and then having the ability to actually publicly speak and not sound like you're just mumbling idiot. That's always tough. Yeah,
that was a big deal for me when I first started having to do that, you know. Yeah. They're like, everybody was like, you got to be able to write about it and you got to be able to
talk about it.
And you know, I was, you know, beyond shy about doing that sort of thing. I'm not now. I guess I got over that hump, but it was not easy at first, and I kind of, you know, I definitely side with the people who have a hard time in the early stages about having to do things like that. It's not easy at all.
No. Practice, practice.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Talk to Anne, she'll cry for you. Yeah. That's the worst thing I've ever seen. No, you would never say that. But
no.
You still might cry about it.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, so after all these years, and you've been doing this stuff for a long time, how do you still stay so inspired and motivated with the photography? If it's still bringing you to tears and reviews and making you smile, like, why do you think that is for all this time?
That's a good question. I mean, I still love it. I still believe in the art of photography. You know, it's changed a lot with digital photography and iPhones and like everyone's photographer now. There's still, like, I still see enough unique work, personal work. When I was at Reiko, we started an artist in residence program. We helped a lot of people, kind of like Clea McKenna and Megan Rippenhoff. A lot of these kind of people are art stars now, McNair Evans. A lot of people have gotten Guggenheims, you know. I went this past December, right before I got the flu, I went to fundraiser for First Exposures, and Clea McKenna had made 10 unique prints for them to sell, to raise money. And they were so beautiful. I did almost cry. I was like, oh my God. And it was just, you know, the beauty of those prints, I was taken aback. So it's like, oh, right, this is why I love this. This is why I really love this. And I was so, you know, seen her from the very beginning. Like, she came to us as a resident artist right out of graduate school. And so I've seen her kind of arc. And this is, it's like, what next? Because this is this whole new thing. And like, what's next? So I think that seeing that people are still making something completely new that I've never, ever seen before, that that's still a possibility, like, that keeps me engaged and looking and excited. And you know, and every time I open my computer, I just don't know, like, who's going to contact me with what. You know, like, someone whose work I love, I'm not going to mention the names, they message me on Facebook, and they're like, is there a submission process to the gallery? And I was like, oh my God, I love your work. Just send it. But it was like, oh, they found me, right? It's like someone I showed their work before they became who they are, you know, and it's easy. I mean, it's not easy, but it's exciting. It's like, because they're also someone who's totally growing. Right. So I guess that's interesting to me, that people don't like plateau. Oh, they do. But then there's a number of people that don't plateau. They just keep making new, exciting work. So,
right. It's like finding treasure in a way.
Yeah.
You dig a lot of holes, but you don't always find what you're looking for.
Right. Right. And especially, I mean, I think that's just something that because I'm committed to those old processes, that, you know, I've landed in a place where like a lot of people are still like, I have a wooden camera. Yeah, I'm in. Like, like, then, so no matter how young I am, which is crazy because I came from San Francisco where I'm like, you know, I was an old hag in San Francisco, but I'm pretty young in Carmel. But I can, you know, I'm still like, kind of an old soul because I haven't, I'm like the one person that hasn't switched to digital. Hmm. But anyway, I see a lot of good digital work too. I shouldn't dismiss it. I mean, I see a lot of good digital work too.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Same here. But it's funny too, because I think myself, like you have people gravitate to you who are, you know, are indebted and completely involved to the old processes, you know, whether you want to call it historical or alternative or experimental. I mean, the craftsmanship behind it, I think, is what kind of sets it apart.
Yeah.
Not that you can't have a high level of craftsmanship with digital, because obviously you can. It's just a different, I don't know, it's hard to explain. It's a very different thing. And again, going back to the like online reviews, as great and as accessible as they can be, when you're looking at kind of analog work, you, like if somebody's showing you platinum prints on Zoom, you just don't, it just doesn't quite carry over. It's not the same thing.
No. I really like how, you know, some artists are reinterpreting the old processes and doing like totally new things with it. It's like,
yeah, a lot of hybrid stuff.
Like Paula Riff, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Like we have the Paula Riff Award at CPA now that, you know, we co-host with Lens Scratch that we give an award every year, and goes to an experimental photographer. And it's so I do a first look at through the submissions to get rid of like the fashion photography and the, you know, document, like things that just don't fit in, but I get to I get to see everything and I'm like, holy cow, these people are doing amazing things. And there's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, the lengths that people will go to accomplish their idea is amazing.
Yeah.
Even now.
I still have hope.
I like that. That's good. I'm glad.
That's the quote right there.
Yep. We're going to go out with that. That's going to be like the end right there. I still have hope. End.
I was hoping my cats would make an appearance. I could be like, and then these are the men in my life. But no, didn't happen.
What are your cats' names?
Big Boo and LB, which stands for Little Boo.
Oh, very imaginative.
Yeah, they just kind of, it's kind of worked out. They had other names, but that's what they want to be. So. And the big one is like 20-odd pounds. He's like a monster. Mm. But, yeah. But, you know, once you start talking about your cat, the whole podcast dies, so you just get rid of this part.
The listener is just like...
Yeah, thanks. This was really fun. It was good to see you. It was okay. Yeah.
It was all right.
Everything that you said about Anne is like spot on, like all of the things that she's done and all of the places she's been. I mean, she has an immense skill set and a wealth of knowledge. I mean, being a printer, a teacher, gallery director, curator, and she herself has become more or less an icon of, or a hub, certainly, of the Bay Area photo community. Mm. In and around San Francisco, certainly Oakland, everywhere in the Bay Area. Anybody who's ever done a review with her, whether you're there as an artist or another reviewer, to see her in action, I mean, she, the way she engages with people and talks to them and helps, I mean, she shows an incredible amount of work. She showed an incredible amount at Rayco, and she shows an incredible amount now where she's at the center. I mean, it's hard to think of anybody else who can show that much work in a physical sense in a gallery setting as she does.
Yeah. But she makes it look, she makes it look easy, and she's kind of silly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, how do you get all this shit done and be this silly and this easy
she
going?
She is kind of silly.
Yeah. I don't get it.
But that's why we love her.
Yeah.
And even when things get crazy or off the rails, she's kind of very relaxed about everything. Like,
I know
her demeanor and how you perceive her on the outside. It doesn't matter what's going on inside. She's like, you're like, this person's solid.
Right.
I can trust this person and I can engage with this person in a very meaningful way.
I like that.
Right? That's profound, right? Yeah. I wrote that down.
Deep Thoughts by Kirchhoff.
Deep Thoughts.
You said hub. That's a great word. Mm-hmm. She is a hub for sure. I don't know if she'd like to be called a hub. I mean, yeah, it's kind of weird.
She's so a hub.
Maybe we should look up what hub means before we start calling it, that kind of thing.
Is there a slang version?
I don't know. Of it hub? Could be. What's the what's the slangopedia? What is that?
Yeah.
Better look that up before we start like thinking it's a compliment.
Well, we mean it as one.
Right. Yes. It's all about what it's not what we said, it's how we said it.
Let me just verbalize that we mean that she's a hub in only the most positive way. You know what was really great about the conversation that we had with Anne as well is I don't know exactly how long I've known her. It's like, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. I learned more about her through this conversation than I had ever really known before. Even after knowing her for that amount of time, there were some things that I found, I don't know, not surprising, but eye-opening, certainly. It just makes me respect her that much more as a part of our community. Because before, I really only had a little bit of respect, and now there's like a moderate amount.
The cup is not half full anymore.
No. Well, it's getting fuller. It's getting fuller. Fuller.
So, yeah, the respect is only like 3/4, but the love is like 100% full.
Yeah, true.
Right, yeah. And she's good people.
She's just good people.
Yeah.